second service this morning. If you ever meet my mother, I want you to tell her that she won. Okay? If you weren't in second service, then you can ask the folks in second service what this is about. But my mother asked me if you would wear a tie on Sunday morning to honor the Lord, why would you not wear it on Sunday night? So this is a tie that Miss Ava over here dared me to wear some time back. So I'm going to take it off now because you'll be trying to figure out what is on it. If you can't see, it's Moses holding the Ten Commandments up over his head. He's about to take them out. Okay? So I've had that tie for about 10 years, and I just never have found the appropriate time or place to wear it, and I don't think I've found it yet. So, also, I read a long time ago of some preacher, and I wish I could remember who it was. It was some old famous preacher who said, when I go down to my grave, I will not have yet said half of what I feel is within me. And I think I feel some of that same way, and particularly when I have the opportunity to spend some time on a topic. And I got that opportunity to spend some time on a topic that I hadn't looked at in a long, long time. When Elton asked me to fill in for his class a couple of weeks ago, and I wasn't about to touch the Washingtonesis Codex manuscript and try to pick up where he is with that. But I did talk some about manuscripts in general, and I didn't get to say all I wanted to say. And so I'm going to take this Sunday night and hopefully finish saying some of the things that I wanted to say. And I put it in the class in the context of, can I trust my Bible? And we just talked a little bit generically about the value of manuscript evidence, and that manuscript evidence helps us have confidence in the accuracy of the text. Manuscript evidence is not used as evidence of inspiration, necessarily. If it was, it would be very secondary. But it is used, you use other things, by the way, as evidence of inspiration. You have two kinds of evidence. You have external evidence. You have internal evidence. And internal evidence would be things like fulfillment of prophecy and so forth. Those would be the kind of things that you would go to when you talk about is the Bible inspired, and show if you can show that a prophecy was uttered hundreds and hundreds of years before it actually came to pass, and it actually came to pass exactly as it was predicted that it would, then you know that someone is behind all of this. And that's the kind of evidence that you would use when you talk about evidence of inspiration. But this type of evidence is more about, how can I know that the Bible that I have right now is the same thing that was written when it was originally written, and how accurate is it? That's the kind of thing that you look to manuscripts for. And I'm not going to go back and reteach the class, but I did introduce something that I would like to pursue a little further. Talking about this type of evidence, and you think about finding a copy of a manuscript, an ancient manuscript, and what is the value of that? If you find a manuscript that, say, you can date back to 400 or 600 A.D., what good is that to me? What value is that? Well, at the very least, it shows that whatever it is that you're looking at, in this case, the Bible, existed in that form prior to the time that you found that manuscript. And so the accusations that people level against the Bible quite often today, and it's not unique to today, it's been with every generation, that the Bible, particularly the New Testament, is just made up by men, it's just myth, this is just something that was manufactured by people hundreds of years after he existed. And so if you can go back early, the earlier that you can go back and find evidence of the Bible being what we have today, then you can know at least this much. You can know that that information was around in that same form at that same time. And so if we can go back to, say, 150 A.D. and find entire gospel accounts, then you're getting back pretty close to the time that these folks lived and when these New Testament books were written. And so that's the general value of manuscripts, that you can have confidence in your Bible. And lots of people don't have any interest in it because you have never had someone question it. But if you ever do have someone question, or if ever there are ever any doubts in your mind, then it's worth your time to take some time and look at the evidence that's there. There's been so much written about it now, and much of it is condensed down into very readable form so that you don't have to wade through volumes and volumes and volumes of things in order to glean some good, some things that you can use on a practical basis. In fact, I recommended a book that many of you probably have in your library, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, Volume 1 by Josh McDowell. Not Volume 2, but Volume 1. And it has some really, really good condensed material. It was actually originally written for college students. And don't let that scare you off, because it's not hard to read. It's really about as simple a form as I think you'll find in as practical a form. So if you would like to pursue some of this further, then I would recommend that to you. We also talked a little bit, and I want to pick up the thought again, about a distinction between providing evidence and proving something. We've talked about this at least at times before, but I want to... This concept took a lot of pressure off of my life because I grew up believing that you had to prove things to people. And I don't believe that anymore. I don't believe that's my job. If it is, then I'm doomed to failure in many, many, many cases because there's some folks you can't prove anything to. Really. And so it's not my job to prove something. It is my responsibility to provide evidence in the most reasonable, loving way that I can that I believe is evidence that would lead a person to certain conclusions. That's my job, to present evidence, not to prove. And I introduced the concept of a court trial. We talked a little bit about what's the responsibility of the prosecuting attorney. And the responsibility of a prosecuting attorney in a court trial is to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused person committed the crime for which they're being accused, being tried. That's their job. And the defense attorney has the responsibility to demonstrate that he doesn't have to prove that the person is innocent. He doesn't have to do that. It'd be good if he could do that, but that's pretty hard to do. But his responsibility is to demonstrate that the evidence that is presented is either irrelevant, invalid, inaccurate, or inconclusive. Therefore, creating a reasonable doubt as to whether or not that person is guilty. And so you have a courtroom scene. Now, let me ask you this question, since we're right there, because I like to pursue lines of reasoning always one step further. Which one do you think is the easiest job? To prove someone guilty or to acquit that person? Which one do you think is easier? Well, my response to that would be, it depends on your jury. I have known of situations where someone maybe drank a hot cup of coffee and burned themselves. And they had a jury that was very sympathetic toward that. Or maybe somebody had something happen to them while they were out in a grocery grocery store, they slipped and they fell, and you have a jury of persons who think, well, this company's got lots of insurance anyway, it's not going to hurt anybody, so let's just award them millions of dollars for this. So I'm going to say, which one has the easiest job? Well, that depends on the jury. And I'm going to say, in that same vein, you may or may not have a relatively easy job proving to someone that the Bible is accurate, or that Jesus lived, or that the gospel is real. That depends on that person's mindset. And by that, I mean there are some people who don't want to believe. They have their own agenda of why they don't want there to be a God. They don't want there to be a judgment. They don't want there to be a hell. They don't want there to be a heaven. And so they're going to be really, really hard to persuade, maybe impossible to persuade, to prove. But that doesn't keep us from giving evidence. And as we give evidence, one of the witnesses that we call to the witness stand is manuscripts. That's what they are. They're witnesses. And you have to think of how you handle a witness. You have to be careful that you know what that witness is going to say if you're going to put them up there, right? Because it might backfire on you. They might say something completely different than you expected them to say. And it might do the opposite of what you wanted to accomplish. And so as we look at manuscripts and we think about what their testimony is going to be and what that's going to accomplish. And you think about the people to whom, the jury, as it were, the people to whom you are trying to give this evidence to and cause them to come to a conclusion. Then the Bible talks about that there are some people who are ever learning and never able to acknowledge the truth. That there are some people that their sole purpose in life is to hear and tell of some new philosophy. And that person's never going to draw conclusions. They're going to keep gathering information. They're going to keep playing the role of the skeptic or the doubter. And they're never going to come to conclusions. And we have lots of people that way in our society today. They just keep wanting more and more and more evidence. It's kind of like Jesus said, the Greeks are looking for wisdom and the Jews demand a sign. And Jesus said, they're not going to get any more sign except the prophet Jonah. You remember what that was, right? That was that Jesus was going to die and be in the grave for 3 days, just like Jonah was in the belly of a big fish for 3 days. He said, that's the last sign they're going to get. Because they have received more than enough signs to know that Jesus Christ is who he claimed to be, and yet they won't draw that conclusion. And so if you added in one more sign or 100 more signs, that's still not going to make any difference to them. And so take some pressure off of yourself by realizing it's not your responsibility to convince everybody in the world of anything. God's not going to judge you by how many people you've convinced of this. That's not what you're about. And that's not what I'm about. But we are about presenting reasonable evidence with the right attitude. And enough evidence that would cause a person who's seeking to know God to be able to have confidence in God and in the Bible. Another observation while I'm just kind of throwing some things out, still in the vein of our lawsuit concept, anybody can sue for anything. Anybody can make any accusation that they want to against God and Jesus and the Bible. And people do. And much of it is out of sheer ignorance. Because many of these people, I'm going to say, most of these people have never read the Bible. And yet they reject it out of hand because of something that someone said or because they have some agenda that causes them to not want to believe that there's a God. And so anybody can make any accusation. And if you'll refer back to a Bulletin article last week, I kind of referred to that a little bit, a couple of reasons why some people don't want to believe, why they won't believe. Many or most of these accusers have never sincere effort to build, to construct something. There's two totally different mindsets, two different personalities and persons. So manuscripts are witnesses. They're witnesses that testify to the accuracy of the Bible. And we need to know what kind of evidence they offer. Ideally, who is the very best witness type that you can call to the witness stand? An eyewitness, exactly. So our first question is, are any of these manuscripts eyewitnesses? Well, generally speaking, no. Alright? Elton is teaching us a class about the Codex W, Washingtonensis Codex, that it may be really, really close. We may be dealing with people who are eyewitnesses. But at least generally speaking, manuscripts do not represent eyewitnesses. They come really, really close. So if we don't have an eyewitness to whatever it is that we're trying to prove, then we want to know how close were these witnesses to the original. How closely related were they? Was there, if you're thinking about a crime scene, was there months separating what this person knows and what actually happened here? In the case of Bible manuscripts, were there hundreds and hundreds of years separating this first witness to what it is that we're trying to examine? How close can we get back? How near the original can we find a witness? And if we can find a witness for something like this within less than 100 years, we're getting back really, really close here. How do we determine how close these manuscripts were to the original? Well, that's another study. It's the dating process. And how can we go back? And there are lots of different things. The type of ink that's used, the type of material that it was written on, the way that the letters were constructed, what letters were used. There were certain letters in whole manuscripts. Sometimes there's one or two letters that give you a real clue as to how far back you can trace this, because certain ways of making a Greek letter fell out of vogue at a certain time. And so that's a study within itself. The next question is, was there more than one witness? Was there just one witness? You know, in the Old Testament judicial system, a person couldn't be convicted of a crime with just one witness. It had to be at least two. Now, by the way, that means something. We get kind of bent out of shape, and from some perspective, maybe we should, when somebody that we're convinced is guilty walks free because there wasn't enough evidence. But do you realize that that had to have happened many times in the Old Testament also? That there was one eyewitness to a crime, and if there was only one eyewitness, then God said, he walks. You can't convict a man with just one eyewitness. And so, I'm saying, God evidently felt like it was more important that at least sometimes a guilty person walk than that an innocent person be convicted of something they didn't do. And our judicial system has picked up that same concept, hasn't it? Infuriates us sometimes. We don't like it sometimes. But there's a principle there that goes all the way back to the Old Testament. How many witnesses do we have? How many manuscripts are there that testify to this? And then another question is, how helpful is their testimony? Is it legible? Is it something that you can know for sure? You can date back to a certain time that you can read and you can compare to what we have today? Does it support interesting study sometime, and you can go on the internet. You can find anything on the internet now. But you can go on the internet and find a comparison of manuscript evidence for the New Testament as compared to manuscript evidence for the Quran, for instance. Pretty interesting stuff. I'm not going to go into that, but the Quran was written considerably later. The first canonized version that we have of the Quran is about 650 A.D. And you go back and see how far that is removed from the original, and then go back and compare that to how far removed we have thousands of manuscripts that are far, 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 far closer to the time that the New Testament was written. And yet, well, let's just say that that's an interesting study just to show you, give you some evidence. It's not, no one argument is conclusive, but when you keep putting them all, piling them on top of one another, it gets pretty obvious. Realize that manuscript evidence must be considered separately for the Old Testament and for the New Testament because they were written a long, long ways apart. And in Elkin's class, we're focused on the New Testament. Actually, we're focused on the Gospels. It's specifically what this codex is focused on. And I heard him say this morning that he's going to show some of the manuscripts for the text of the New Testament also in upcoming lessons. But let me say a word about the Old Testament, because that would be the one, obviously, the closer to today that you get, the more you would expect to have evidence, right? But if you go back thousands of years, you would reasonably know that there wouldn't be the volume of evidence that would go back that far as it would if it were written just in a relatively short time ago. But remarkably, there are thousands of Old Testament manuscripts in the Middle East, the Mediterranean, and Europe, which just phenomenally agree with one another. We also have the Septuagint version, which is translation of the Old Testament into from Hebrew and Aramaic into Greek around 285 B.C. And it's a complete version. And by the way, this was the Bible that Jesus carried around in his hip pocket. I'm sorry, but it wasn't the King James Version. But it was. This is the version that he used, the Septuagint and the Apostles. And then in the 1940s, beginning in the mid-40s into the early 50s, something was discovered that has been an incredible find, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls, this is a new witness that steps forward. And this witness says, hey, I've got something to say about this. And it's brand new. We don't know what he's going to say. And so we're waiting on pens and needles to find out what are these manuscripts going to say. And there's an incredible number of them. And they date at the time that they were found, and you grab this, okay? At the time they were found, they predated the earliest manuscripts that we had by 1,000 years. So it's going to be pretty important what they say, isn't it? If you go back that much further and you can translate what they say and it's still what is said in our text today, you're gaining lots of confidence really, really fast. This is a really, really important witness to step forward here. And so is he going to cast doubt on the accuracy of the Bible? Is he going to be a witness for the prosecution? Is he going to be a witness for the defense? Well, we don't know. And then when the jury comes in, there is a 95%+ match with exactly the Old Testament that we have today. And if that 5% distresses you a little bit, let me try to relieve you of some of that distress. It was things like Elkin was talking about in our class today, even though that wasn't specifically what he was addressing. He was talking about colons or double stops and single stops. Well, this 5% of, if you want to call it discrepancy, of things that weren't exactly the same, were made almost completely up of things like that. Small, some differences in punctuation. And so if we had the time, we could illustrate that of those 5% of differences, they were so minute and insignificant that not one textual meaning was caused to be questioned by the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was that consistent with our Old Testament Bible today. That's a witness, folks. That's an incredible witness. What about the New Testament? Well, there exists today more than 24,000 manuscripts, 24,000 manuscripts, either complete or whole, of the New Testament. And 230 of them predate 600 A.D. Now, I brought this up last time, and we start having high expectations of manuscripts, but I want to remind you of something again. How long do you expect a pair of shoes to last? Well, I've got some that's pretty old now, but, you know, 40 years is a pretty good while for a pair of shoes to last, right? I mean, you know, if they were 100 years old, they're probably not something that you could wear, right? So what my point is, remember what these manuscripts, what the material was that they were written on. It was papyrus, which is plant material, or it was leather. That doesn't last a long, long, long time. And so the very fact that we have a multiplicity of manuscripts that are literally thousands of years old is incredible itself. That we have anything that's preserved, because in order for it to be preserved, it had to be in some really highly specialized circumstances, didn't it? There couldn't be much moisture around, could it? That's why you find most manuscripts in very arid places. If they found them, there couldn't be much moisture around. They couldn't have had lots of severe weather that could reach it and so forth. And so fires and all the kind of things that destroy materials comes into play. And so the life expectancy of leather is, for all practical purposes, the life expectancy of a manuscript. So the fact that we have any, and particularly thousands of them, is really, really a remarkable thing. And that any of them even get remotely close to the originals is incredible. Now, if you would, I have a little comparison. If you would, throw those charts up, and let me just make a little comparison here. These would be histories, ancient histories, secular manuscripts, and down here on the side are some of the ones. Some of you have read some portions of some of these. These are still available. You can still read these histories. This is when they were written. This is the earliest copies that we have of them. And notice B.C. and A.D. When you see 425 and 900, remember one's B.C. and other's A.D. 1,300 years time span from the time that it was originally written until the earliest manuscript that we have in existence to prove that Herodotus wrote this history. 1,300 years, and we have 8 copies of it. And that's one of the more well-preserved ones. And as you go on down to different ones, Tacitus, Greek history, written 100 A.D., earliest copy, 1,100, that's 1,000 years. There are 20 copies of manuscripts that date that far back. And you can look at, if you would, flip to the next slide. Make a comparison here. Now, here's biblical manuscripts. And I made a note here, you don't have to put how many manuscripts, because these are individual manuscripts right here, okay? And these are, and if you were to put, this is Codex Alexandrinus, Sinaiticus, Vaticanus, and Elton's going to have pictures of that in 2 or 3 weeks for those manuscripts for you, and you can see those. And so these are names that people have given to manuscripts that have been discovered. This is when they were written. This is the earliest copies that we have. And this is the time span between when it was written and the earliest copies. Now I want you to look at this. And yet people don't question whether or not Herodotus wrote the history that is attributed to him, or Pliny the Elder, whether or not he wrote it. People don't question that. But they question the Bible. And look how close that we can get back to manuscripts that are major manuscripts. These are not just little pieces. These are large manuscripts. How closely we can get back to the original right here. Now, if you would, go to the third slide. Well, I can't read it that far back, so I'm going to have to read up here, okay? Harold Greenlee says that the quotations description the works of the early Christian writers are, quote, so extensive that the New Testament could virtually be reconstructed from them without the use of New Testament manuscripts. Bruce Metzger, some of you have read some of his material, says, indeed, so extensive are these citations that if all other sources for our knowledge of the text of the New Testament were destroyed, they would be sufficient alone for the reconstruction of practically the entire New Testament. That's just these ones that we looked at a few moments ago. Sir David Dalrymple was asked, suppose the New Testament had been destroyed and every copy of it lost by the end of the 3rd century. Could it have been collected together again from the writings of the fathers of the 2nd and 3rd centuries? His response, that question roused my curiosity, and as I possess all of the existing works of the fathers of the 2nd and 3rd centuries, I commenced a search. And up to this time, I have found the entire New Testament except 11 verses. Now, that's incredible, folks. That's incredible, incredible evidence. Until this last decade, right now, things are still coming to light, by the way. Until this last decade, it was believed that the oldest known large manuscript dated to 120 A.D. Now think about 120. The New Testament was completely written when? Well, some folks will say by A.D. 70. Most scholars will say by the mid-90s, by like 95. Many think that Revelation was written, but certainly by the destruction of Jerusalem, A.D. 70. And probably more likely by the 90s. So if it was completed in the 90s, and we have a manuscript 120, how far removed are we from it? It's not impossible to think that a person who wrote that could have been and would have been alive when John wrote his gospel account, which would have been one of the later ones, and the book of Revelation. And maybe even others before that. And if this Codex W proves to have been written by the end of the 1st century, we will now have 4 manuscripts come to light in the last decade. 4 manuscripts that have been dated even earlier than 120 A.D. And so we're getting back really, really, really close to the original writer, which would mean that the eyewitnesses that we've called to the stand were alive at the time that at least some portions of the New Testament were being written. And so we may have accounts, and this is exactly what Elkin is saying to us, we may have writers who are writing at the time that the original writers were still alive. And we may have manuscripts preserved from that time when they were still alive. Now, that's getting to be really, really strong evidence, isn't it? And besides these manuscripts, we have more than 15,000 existing copies. Besides the 24,000, we have more than 15,000 existing copies of various versions that are written in Latin and Syriac, which date as early as 150 A.D. Now, you tell me what somebody's thinking when they throw all this stuff out, that you can't believe the Bible is just something that was made up hundreds of years after Jesus came along by his followers, and it's all mythology. There is no work of antiquity which even comes close to having the kind of manuscript evidence that our Bible has, both Old and New Testament. Any reasonable person who will be objective and objectively consider the evidence of the Folks, the Lord did not leave us without witness. And this is just one of the witnesses that we can call to attest to the validity of the Bible. Most detractors, again, let me say, have never read the Bible. Most critics never have. And they almost certainly, most of them, have never examined the evidence. Anybody can sue anybody for anything. You can bring anything to court. You can make any accusation you want to. And at least for some folks, it makes them feel intelligent. You know that everybody's an expert in football and religion. Now, there are not too many people that claim to be experts in Elton's field. You notice that? But religion, everybody is an expert. And whatever we've heard is true. And so we just throw it out and we build our lives on it. The scriptures, the Bible said, which are able to make you wise unto salvation. God has not left us without a lamp, without a light to guide us through this world. And one that we can have complete confidence in. He not only has left us his word, but he has left us an incredible amount of evidence so that we can know that his word is true, that we have that word today, and we can base our lives on that word. Let's stand and sing.